Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Christopher Miller, Ukraine correspondent for the Financial Times and author of The War Came to Us, Life and Death in Ukraine, which was published in July. We're going to talk today about Chris's book, his experiences covering the war and the run-up to the war several years. He was there in Ukraine, and also where things stand in terms of the war after President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to the United States last week. Thanks very much for joining me today, Chris.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me on. It's good to be chatting with you again.
Yes, very good to talk to you again. Now, as I said, Chris is the Financial Times correspondent in Ukraine, but in the past, he's done some great work for Radio for Europe, some of which I've had the pleasure to edit and work with him on. A couple of things that stand out have been an account of actually finding the site in the Donbass from where the missile that brought down flight MH17, killing 298 passengers and crew, was fired back in July 2014. And separately, also, another thing that stands out in Chris's reporting for us in the past is a report titled The Executioners of Slavyansk, which identified several militants who ordered the killings of Ukrainians, the extrajudicial execution of Ukrainians by firing squad early in the Donbass war. Now, before we start, I just wanted to mention a recent change in the format. It's getting less recent, but we're no longer conducting this podcast on the social network formerly known as Twitter. Instead, we are recording it in the studio. Now, this is a return to past practice, but with a twist. While we cannot take questions live, we do invite listeners to send questions in advance on the topics at hand. I don't believe we received any questions. This has happened a few times. So I just want to put out a reminder or a call for people in the future. Please, we welcome your questions on the topics and addressed to the guest. So thanks for that. Now, as before, you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, let's get started, Chris. Let's talk about your book first. I understand that it covers a period of some years before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 22, in addition to the time since then. So it looks at kind of the war that broke out in the Donbass in 2014 and the occupation of Crimea by Russia that year, but perhaps also goes back before those events. And I guess maybe the best approach is if you could tell us a little bit about your earliest travels to Ukraine and kind of how the book came about and what you feel you've accomplished with it. Maybe that's not the right word, but what you feel is important about the book. But also, I'd be interested in hearing what you think is the best part of the book, or what was the most interesting or enlightening or heartbreaking part, I guess, to report on and to write.
Yeah, sure. You've touched on or you've put forward several questions there, but from the beginning, right, which is where the book starts as well. The book begins in spring of 2010, when I first arrived in Ukraine, not as a journalist, actually, but as a United States Peace Corps volunteer. I had just recently graduated from university in the United States, in Oregon, my home state, and was living in Portland and working with local media there when I made the decision to join the Peace Corps. And the Peace Corps had asked me where I wanted to go, and I had said, I'm really interested in actually heading to someplace in Africa for a while, or even South America. In Eastern Europe, I think was my second choice, second or third choice. But you know, they said, sure, we'll look at things and let you know. And first they said I would be heading to Africa, but eventually they came back to me and said, we would like to send you to Ukraine. We think you'd be a good fit there, and we have some openings in this next round of volunteers that we're going to be sending in there. How does that sound? And I was up for just about anything at that point. And it was a new, fascinating place that I had at the time no link to. I'm not of Ukrainian descent. I did not study Russian studies or Eastern European studies at university. I actually took Japanese as a middle schooler and high schooler. So my interest in foreign affairs was not focused on Eastern Europe, yet that's where I ended up. And perhaps more interestingly, now I ended up not only in Ukraine, but in Eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk Oblast, and specifically in a city called Artyomovsk at the time, which is today called Bakhmut. And that name, many of your readers will know and recognize as being the location of the longest and bloodiest battle that's been fought between Ukrainian forces and Russian forces that, well, more or less culminated in May in the Russian capture and almost complete destruction of the city. But long before it was the target of Russian forces, I lived in Bakhmut for 2 years, between 2010 and 2012, and got to know the place and the people very well. I worked in a couple of schools in the city. I worked in the central library and had an English club and a journalism club there, and made a lot of friends. And it became my temporary home, but a place that I returned to many times each year after I left in 2012. And so, you know, that's where the book begins. And I chose to begin the book with my arrival in the first 2 years in Bakhmut, Eastern Ukraine, because, you know, this was a really fascinating period of time. I had arrived just a couple of months after former President Viktor Yanukovych had taken office. Mm-hmm. And this was viewed by many Ukrainians and people in the West as a step backward after electing Viktor Yushchenko, who was viewed as a much more European-style leader and someone who was trying to take Ukraine on a more westward, democratic European path. Viktor Yanukovych was elected in 2010, and so there was this step back, and his election saw rampant corruption really take hold of the country. You know, he was known to have stolen billions of dollars and made himself and his cronies in the Russia-friendly Party of Regions very, very wealthy before he was ousted by revolutionaries during the Euromaidan or Revolution of Dignity a few years later in 2014. Mm-hmm. But that period of time also saw the repression of journalists and civil society and activists and really a crackdown on dissent and this move toward a more post-Soviet autocracy style of government rather than the more democratic government or style of governing that Ukraine had hoped for and much of the West had hoped for at the time. And so the early pages of the book look at, you know, me using me as the sort of vehicle to take you on this journey that I went on through Eastern Ukraine. You get to know what Eastern Ukraine is like. You get to meet a lot of people who were and still are my close friends. You meet politicians. You get to know what life is like for these people under the Yanukovych government, and that you know really sets us up for what we see in the fall of 2013, which was these Euromaidan protests that would evolve into a full-blown revolution. And, you know, so the early part of the book does start with my travels, and it gets into the culture, and you learn about the politics and the people before I eventually return by 2013 into to journalism and then working as a foreign correspondent there. And you know, I thought it was important to include that bit as well as the Revolution of Dignity, Euromaidan, and also following that, the annexation of Crimea by Russia, the early stages of Russia's invasion, because it really helps tell the story and I think provide really important context to Russia's full-scale invasion today. And in hindsight, you know, I and we have the benefit now of seeing a lot of signs that I think we missed over the years and may have maybe should have paid more attention to, and had we done so, we maybe being not only journalists but maybe the collective West and our leaders in the West, you know, maybe there are things we could have done to have stopped Russia's full-scale invasion. And so I think there are, you know, some of those things along the way in this book that come out. And there's what I think is a very interesting conversation and interview with the acting president of Ukraine after Yanukovych was overthrown by the revolution. This was an interview I did with Oleksandr Turchynov, in which he talks about how the Obama administration at the time in 2014, spring of 2014, as Russian forces were making their way across Crimea in the early weeks of the annexation, mm-hmm. He was asking for help. And the West was, just as Ukraine was, very unprepared for this, I think caught off guard by Russia's annexation and unsure of what exactly to do, but clear in its message that Ukraine should stand down and not respond in Crimea because it could lead to escalation. And that's a message that you know, we hear a little bit of still today, this Western hesitance, you know, for Ukraine to defend itself. And it's a part of the conversations today when we are talking about Western military assistance for Ukraine and how and when the West decides to send various missile systems or F-16 jets to Ukraine over, you know, some concern that they could be used against Russia on Russian soil rather than in occupied territories. So not to digress too much, but, you know, all of that is in the book, and I thought it was important to provide those bits of reporting in that long period of time, also because, you know, what I like to read as a reader is a story and a narrative. And what I saw in looking for books on Ukraine were a lot of books that were history books and written by academics, and they provide great historical perspective and understanding of the Holodomor, for example, or the Soviet period of Ukraine or post-Soviet period of Ukraine. There's a lot written about Ukraine's politicians and a lot written about Vladimir Putin and his view of Ukraine, but there haven't really been many narrative driven books about the country. And so I felt that as though I was in a unique position really to provide that type of a story and in a book. And one that I thought really would also provide a lot of insight into the people and culture and highlight a lot of really important stories and things that happened prior to the full-scale invasion that, I think are worth knowing. And you know, also to, again, look at the bigger picture. You know, this isn't a war that has been going on, you know, just since February 24th, 2022. It's a war that Russia has been waging against Ukraine now for more than 9 years. And so writing the book in the way that I did was also a way in which I could really underscore that this is a war that has been ongoing and unfortunately, doesn't have any end in sight. So I think that that answers hopefully all of your questions in terms also of what I think it's accomplished. Lastly, you asked what I found to be maybe interesting or enlightening or heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I mentioned that interview with Turchynov, which has gotten quite a lot of attention actually, and I would underscore that and say that is certainly an interesting part of the book to read. in the context of what's happening now and the West's hesitation to provide certain weapons for Ukraine. I think there are, you know, you mentioned the reporting that I did for us at RFURL when I was working with you on the executions in Slavyansk. And I wrote a version of that for the book. And I think that, you know, that is one thing, along with the story of MH17 and discovering the launch site, that have really stuck with me. I think a lot about the consequences of those moments and what they've meant. You know, the executions by Igor Strokov Gherkin, the Russian commander in eastern Ukraine, who boasts that he, you know, fired the first shot of the war, that really set a really dark and disturbing tone for Russia's war against Ukraine and what happens under Russian occupation. And, you know, we were shocked when we saw what happened during Russia's occupation of Bucha and other cities in Ukraine in the past year and a half. But, you know, we saw signs of that brutality much earlier in this war. In 2014, there were people who were tortured, abused, and even murdered in cold blood and executed by firing squad, like this reporting that I did for us and other outlets as well earlier on showed. And so, you know, all of that has stuck with me. And, you know, there are many other stories, unfortunately, in the book, too, that are rather disturbing and really do underscore Russia's brutality toward the Ukrainians. But there are also many stories, I think, that show and highlight Ukraine's resilience and defiance. And there are moments that are very inspiring and that I have found inspiring and are largely the reasons which I want to continue doing this reporting. And I've stayed on the story for so long.
Thanks very much, Chris. Just a couple of to go back to a couple points. It sounds like a great treatment of kind of the years running up, you know, through the lens of your having been there first as a Peace Corps volunteer and then as a journalist, kind of the years leading up to you know, to the annexation of Crimea and the war that Russia fomented and then participated in the Donbass, and then leading later in February 2022 to the full scale invasion. It sounds like great background, and as you mentioned, kind of very chilling, disturbing signs in your reporting for us, for RFE, of the kind of thing that was done by the Russian forces in Bucha and many other places following the full-scale invasion. And also interesting, certainly, about the Turchinov interview, the idea of, you know, the U.S. hesitancy and kind of, you know, I think there's a narrative that's pushed for or put forward by Russia, certainly, that obviously the Kremlin, Putin says that the 2014 the ouster or the pressure that caused Yanukovych to essentially abandon office and flee to Russia, you know, was a U.S. backed coup. You know, I think it sounds like the interview is one of the, you know, one of the good pieces of evidence, you know, that this is not what was happening. So that sounds interesting as well. I'd like to go on now to the second question, which is really about what's happening now. You know, obviously you're still there. You're in Kyiv, talking to us from Kyiv, reporting for the Financial Times. You know, as you mentioned, there's no end to the war. At least it's hard to see an end to the war. You know, at this point. You know, Ukraine wants to, of course, push Russian forces out of Ukraine entirely, and Russia is, at the very least, saying, you know, you need to accept our that five regions of Ukraine are actually regions of Russia, four of which Russian forces do not control anywhere near, well, or do not control in their entirety. So, you know, those obviously are positions that are far apart. Ukrainian counteroffensive is happening now. So, and I mentioned Zelensky's trip to the United States last week. He addressed the UN General Assembly in New York, met with U.S. President Joe Biden and with lawmakers in Washington. This is ahead of, obviously, the election, presidential and congressional election coming up, not this November, but next November. And then he went on to Canada. Quite a bit of your reporting for Radio Free Europe a few years back involved what was at the time Ukraine's quite troubled relationship with the United States, basically the time, or I guess between the time Zelensky took office in May 2019 and the U.S. election in November 2020, in which Biden defeated the incumbent Donald Trump. Now, this was all well before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, of course, and the situation is quite different now. But, you know, obviously you've been reporting intensively on the war, the current Ukrainian counteroffensive, and also on the diplomacy, the issue of Western support for Ukraine in terms of weapons, financial aid, and other kinds of backing. I wonder if you could, drawing on your reporting on in the field and in Kyiv, give us kind of an assessment of how things stand following Zelensky's trip to North America.
Yeah, I guess I'll start with, you know, you mentioned Ukraine's, I forget the word you just used, but it's not great relationship with the United States. When I was working with RFERL and reporting on Ukraine and the U.S. at the time, but I think that, you know, that relationship was not great, because I think it was President Trump at the time asking, you know, Zelensky to do him a favor, right? It wasn't that Ukraine was developing its on its own or unilaterally this kind of bad relationship with the United States. I think, you know, the United States largely, and there was bipartisan support for Ukraine here at the time still, was largely, you know, supportive of Ukraine. But of course, you'll remember there was this Trump administration and Trump and President Trump himself, you know, trying to force the newly elected President Zelensky to open these investigations against Trump's then competitor, Joe Biden. I think, you know, that the relationship was restored somewhat with a Biden election victory, and we've seen strong bipartisan support for Ukraine since then and over the course of Russia's full-scale invasion. But if we look at Zelensky's visit to Washington last week, there were absolutely signs of a slight cooling, perhaps, or some hesitancy, I think, particularly on the Republican side. You know, Zelensky was welcomed like a hero last December when he showed up and gave a big emotional and very powerful speech to a joint meeting of Congress. And this time around, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy refused a request by President Zelensky to again speak to a joint meeting of Congress, mm-hmm. and instead asked him to meet in some kind of room off of the, you know, beaten path in the Capitol. I think it was one of the archive rooms, and, you know, it had a much different vibe to it. There were, you know, many fewer people in attendance. Zelensky did not get FaceTime with every member of Congress. And even while he was there, there were some on the further right wing of the Republican Party who continued to criticize the Biden administration's handling of the war in Ukraine and its continued support for it. And part of the major debate in Washington at the moment and among members of Congress is that continued support for Ukraine. And some of these more far right members of Congress are standing in the way of potentially delivering billions more dollars of humanitarian assistance and military assistance to Ukraine. And so Zelensky and his visit this time around really was to shore up that support that he received in the early months of the invasion, that he was ensured of when he arrived back in December of 2022. You know, this was essentially a rescue mission, mm-hmm. Trying to make sure that the billions of dollars in aid is going to keep flowing. They're now realizing, both in Kiev, leaders in Kiev and in Washington, that this war is going to be likely a protracted war. We talked earlier about how it's been going on already for 9 years, but it looks as though it's going to continue going on for more, and at a level and scale that, you know, we're seeing now, which is missile and drone attacks on a daily basis by Russia, right? Not to mention a ground war in the south and the east, nearly 20% of Ukraine's territory occupied, people being killed and maimed on a daily basis, all of the country, not just the east as it was for nearly 8 years or so, under attack. And so he being President Zelensky, came to Washington looking for a long-term security guarantee from Washington to continue to be able to defend for Ukraine to defend itself, and also to help set a tone across other Western nations, and particularly other NATO countries and the EU, that this level of support should continue. The other concern that he was addressing in his meetings in Washington was about the U.S. elections. And, you know, President Trump has not gone away. And the messages from Trump over the last several weeks have been rather flattering toward Russia and Vladimir Putin. And we know that he has some sort of bizarre affinity for Putin, in that he, you know, views him as a strongman leader. And you know, Trump has said things like, "I could solve the war in 24 hours and it would be over." I think it's fair to say that that is impossible. But even if he were to try to solve it in a short period of time, the things that he is suggesting aren't solutions that would be beneficial to Ukraine, and aren't solutions that the Biden administration and even Democratic and Republican lawmakers say would be beneficial to Ukraine and would be a good way to settle this war. And that is very concerning to Kiev, because this would be a second term for Donald Trump. He's essentially coming into the election saying, if I win, I'm going to take vengeance on my political enemies. I'm going to use my powers to the greatest extent imaginable to carry out my agenda. And that is very worrying here in Ukraine, and specifically among Zelensky's camp. So that's that was the context in which, or the climate in which Zelensky arrived in. He did leave with more in terms of military support. Biden announced more air defense, artillery shells, and other military equipment and supplies for Ukraine, which is going to help it its army continue to fight its counteroffensive and to defend itself from Russian airstrikes. We know that through my reporting and other reporting in U.S. media, that Biden also very quietly agreed to send these ATACMS, long-range missiles topped with cluster munitions, to Ukraine, at least in a small batch at first, mm-hmm. See how they might be used. And that's interesting, and certainly a development. The United States had been holding off in sending those, and there had been a very serious debate within the White House and Biden very Biden was very skeptical about sending them, but we learned that in the last couple of weeks he had come around and was going to and did tell Zelensky quietly that they would be sending some of those. Maybe now I'll move on just a bit to the counteroffensive. Mm-hmm. because that was a major topic both in the United States and again in Canada, where Zelensky finished his trip, and also in the United Nations, where Zelensky spoke to both the General Assembly and the Security Council. This is a really important moment for the Ukrainians. This counteroffensive has not gone according to plan. It's been very slow to develop. There were several hurdles that the Ukrainians have had to learn to overcome. These minefields being one of them. They're still these Russian minefields are so dense. They're still giving Ukrainian forces on the ground some major headaches. But they've managed to puncture Russia's front lines in the south. And, you know, his messaging, Zelensky's messaging during his North American trip was that we're making progress. You're backing, you know, you want to back a winner. You're backing a winner here. We're on the right side. And was on the right side or the bright side of things. And that was also his message in Washington and to the UN that, you know, you all need to be on the right side of history here. Russia is on the wrong side. Ukraine is not only fighting for its freedom and independence, but we're fighting for yours as well. And essentially telling people you need to put your money where your mouth is. You claim to support the idea of freedom, independence, and democracy, and to assist burgeoning democracies like Ukraine's. You know, continue to support us. And he came home to Kiev, I think, not riding as high as he did after his December 2022 trip, but he did bring back with him, you know, new security packages, both from the United States and from Canada. News of these attackums did trickle out, and I'm not sure that Zelensky's camp or the Biden administration actually wanted those or that piece of news to be out, as not to tip off the Russians, who I think they would like to surprise with these weapons. But I know from my chatting with my sources here in Kiev that many people found that to be very promising and a sign that there would be continued support and that it would be one fewer thing that they would have to argue for. And now they can continue arguing for other various things that they would like and see as being potentially beneficial in the battlefield, you know, F-16s and other fighter jets being among those things. Mm-hmm. Another element and you know, or sort of cloud hanging over Zelensky's trip was this element of time, you know, time in terms of what the U.S. political situation is going to be like over the coming months and how that might influence the U.S. support for Ukraine, time in terms of whether or not the Ukrainians are able to break through in a really major, meaningful way that would mean the recapture of occupied territory, and if not, what that might mean for Russia in terms of really digging in. Tightening its grip on these occupied regions while also having time to ramp up artillery production and missile production and, really looking at this again as a war that's going to be long term. I think many people here in Ukraine are concerned that time might be on Russia's side simply because it just has it's ramping up production of its artillery shells and other military equipment and that's sort of guaranteed while Western support isn't necessarily so that hopefully that provides some broader context of his trip. I think just to sum it up, you know, it was a successful trip, I think, for Zelensky. I've spoken with a couple of my sources within his administration upon their arrival back here, and they were pleased with it. They were happy with the meetings on the Hill as well, and did find that there remains strong bipartisan support. But again, there is some concern that within the Republican Party, there are people who might have influence enough to change the mind of Speaker Kevin McCarthy, potentially influencing decisions in Congress that are needed in order for this level of United States support to continue for Ukraine.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Chris. That's I mean, that's a great, a very comprehensive but pithy summary of the trip of Zelensky's trip and the counteroffensive and kind of the situation with Western aid or at least U.S. aid and support, as you say, kind of the U.S. elections is a big factor. And it's hard to say how things will develop during the campaign and the election itself, of course. But the idea, I think people have, it certainly seems clear, as you say, that the war is set to continue, in part because of the elections in Russia in March, presidential election next March, and in the U.S. I think that's one of the factors in. I think Putin certainly has no desire or interest in making any compromises, certainly until he finds out what happens in those votes. Not that the Russian one is hard to guess what will happen. But I just wanted to, before we wrap it up, I just wanted to mention, I think it's a very important point you made, or not point, but describing the not just the fact that this war, seems to be destined to go on for a long time, but also the scale and on a daily basis, the scale of the war, with, as you say, about 20% of Ukrainian territory held by Russia and people being killed and maimed in Ukraine every day, attacks throughout the country. So, and I think that kind of detail, that kind of very, very troubling detail about what's happening in people's lives is sometimes kind of glossed over when people talk about the war in kind of a wide scale. So appreciate your pointing that out. And I guess we're going to wrap it up here. Chris, great to talk to you again. Thanks very much for joining me.
Yeah, it was good to chat with you again. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Christopher Miller, Ukraine correspondent for the Financial Times and the author of The War Came to Us, Life and Death in Ukraine. That book was published in July. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. Tune in next week for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, and please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which comes out most Fridays. Thanks for listening.